no helicopters have been procured for me to go to golf course. Thank you.
I've never said he wasn't a great politician. I'm just saying he's a off.
He's listening to you.
How'd you play out there today?
Well, I found the conditions challenging, mostly because there's no grass on the golf course, but there never has been.
I'm thinking about the swag bag, and I have high hopes for the swag bag.
When you got three crevices on the green, your course is trash.
What's happening, folks? Welcome back to the Beltway Golfer Podcast. This is episode 69. I am your host, Alex Dixon. For today's episode, we head out to Argyle Country Club and sit down with Jack Bonifant, who is getting ready to compete in his second U.S. Adaptive Open at Pinehurst, which is taking place July 18th through 20th. Last year was the inaugural year. He qualifies for this event due to a traumatic injury he suffered at just 6 weeks old. And in our conversation, Jack explains the details of the situation, the details of his own disability. But we talk about so much more than that, because obviously Jack is so much more than that. I really enjoyed sitting down with him, getting to know him a little bit. As this episode is coming out, he's actually on his honeymoon with his new bride. So congratulations, Jack. But we get into a lot of stuff. Jack is essentially a lifetime member out at Argyle Country Club. As he says in our conversation, hasn't spent a day on earth where he wasn't a member. And today he's actually on the board at Argyle and competes in, I think he's even the captain of some of their inner club competitions. A couple things to get in before the actual podcast. Geez, the big news. It's been a few weeks since I put out a podcast, but PGA Tour, Jay Monahan, Saudi money, the PIF, Live Tour, a lot going on. I'm not going to say too much about it. I mean, there's so many podcasts about the reaction to what's going on. I think so much of it remains to be seen. I will say this, the only thing that seems to not be in doubt is that PGA Tour Commissioner Jay Monahan comes off looking like, I'm going to reserve final judgment, but what we know so far, he looks like a spineless, two-faced sellout. That's all there really is. And I say that specifically, and this has been well covered, but him bringing the families of 9/11 into this conversation a year ago and basically saying that the PGA Tour would never take money from those that bore some responsibility for what happened on September 11th. And once you do that and then you go and take that money, you got to go. You lose all respect for everybody in the room, and the room right now is the whole world. So unless something comes out that's just, you know, no one's really talked about, or something, the terms of this deal are way different than anyone's imagining, Jay's got to go. Because I don't think anyone, how could anybody respect him? That's all I'll say on the matter. I'll move on. There's so many podcasts, so many shows, so many people talking about the PGA Tour and the PIF and the LIV, and so much of it remains to be seen, if the deal even goes through, because the Department of Justice, we'll see. In other news, hosted our event out of Bretton Woods, the Bankroll. The Bankroll came and went, and we had an awesome time. Anyone listening that was out at the event, I want to thank everyone for showing up. We had a great day. We had perfect weather. We had a two-person better ball. We gave out all kinds of prizes to winners. We had a couple closest to the pin. We had a long drive. We had net winners, gross winners. Started giveaways. I think just about everybody that was out there got some sort of giveaway, both pre and post event. We had great food. Bretton Woods was a fantastic host, and I'm going to do more of these. I'm getting ready to announce the next one. I'm hoping to confirm it tomorrow from when I'm taping this, but I enjoyed kind of getting to know some people that I had communicated with on social media over the years, but never put a face to the name. And it was just a lot of fun. I mean, we lucked out with the weather. We had some great sponsors. Thank you again to Aslan Brewery. Aslan came out Aslan stepped up and provided beer for the entire event. They gave us these really cool tee markers, which were their four-pack boxes. We filled them with sand, put them on each tee box, but they were a great sponsor for the event. Some fantastic beers were had before, during, and after the round of play. Also, want to thank Golfdom for providing some prizes, 5-Iron Golf, 5-Iron DC, as well as Union Green, which all provided some giveaways and some prizes, and it was just a great time. So the bankroll was an A+. We're getting ready to do more. I'm going to announce one certainly before the next podcast, so stay tuned, follow along, especially on Instagram, because that's where I post most often, but also at BeltwayGolfer.com, and of course, sign up for the newsletter on BeltwayGolfer.com, our monthly free newsletter. That announcement will certainly be there. Speaking of Union Green, let me do a Union Green ad read here, because Union Green has been a great partner of ours so far. I actually just put out a reel on Instagram of me testing out the Union Green golf balls alongside the most expensive golf ball brand they had in the pro shop at East Potomac Park, East Potomac Golf Links. And, you know, for someone like myself, I think I'm classified as a mid-handicapper. You know, the feel between a $55 a dozen golf ball and the pin drop, which is what I've been using, which is it retails at $28 for a dozen, is hardly noticeable. I mean, the pin drop, high trajectory, grabs the green, it's got spin on the ball, pin drop works great. And you go to their website, they've got all kinds of discounts. Buy two, get 10% off. Buy three, get 15% off. Buy 4 dozen golf balls, get 25% off. Brings it down to about $22 a golf ball. And they also got a two-piece, the T-Bird, which is specifically for getting a little extra distance, especially on your drive. So check them out. Follow them on social media at Golf Union Green. And their website is uniongreen.com. So thank you to Union Green for sponsoring this show. One more sponsor to talk about, because this is Major Championship Week. We got the U.S. Open coming up at Los Angeles Country Club this week. And so that means we're doing a Betway read, and going to be joined here in a minute by Ellis Gore from Betway. If you want to place wagers on the U.S. Open and get in on the action, look no further. Betway has odds on over 1,000 markets while also offering incredible Betway boosts. And if you haven't tuned in for the first two majors, the podcast, the Betway Golfer podcast, leading into the first two majors, they give me the Betway boost for the major. So stay tuned here in a minute, and I'm going to announce this week's Betway boost with Ellis. But this will be available for this week's U.S. Open. Register today. Get up to $250 back in bonus bets with your first wager. All you need to do is sign up, make an initial deposit, and you'll be ready to bet with Betway. And if real money gaming isn't your thing, you can always take part in Betway's Big Pick Challenges instead. They've got a free-to-play game. Players can make weekly picks on select markets with a cash prize of $5,000 to whoever gets a perfect score. Possibilities are endless over at Betway. Check it out. Visit the site. Download the mobile app today. Real money wagering is at betway.com/sports. Free-to-play gaming is at betwaybigpick.com. Or you can also download the Betway Big Pick mobile app. Please gamble responsibly. Must be 21 years or older to wager with real money. Terms and conditions apply. All right, and so now we are joined from Betway by Ellis Gore, much like we did for the lead up to the Masters and the PGA Championship. And here we are for the third major of the year. What's going on, Ellis?
Not too much, Alex. Thanks for having me again. Happy to be back. Trying to hopefully I can make some better picks this time around.
I hear you. So let's just, much like we did for anybody that tuned in to the last podcast before the PGA Championship, we recapped at least my terrible Masters picks. You did good in the Masters. We're gonna do a quick rundown of how we fared with our picks in the PGA Championship. I'll start. So each time I pick one kind of main pick that turns into the Betway boost, where listeners can go onto the Betway app and they get discounted odds for my main pick. And I misfired. I'm now 0-2 in my Betway boost picks of even making the cut. I went with Cameron Young in the PGA Championship, thought the New York kid was going to make a decent showing, doesn't make the cut. So my first one was a missed cut. My next guy was Victor Hovland. He was T2, so I had a good showing there, but I have a funny anecdote about that. And then the local guy, Denny McCarthy, came T29. So I had a T2 and a T29. not terrible, but my main pick, the one that really matters, miscut. So I got to make up for that. How did your guys do?
It's tough. Cam Young, man, a lot of people liked him going into PJ. So did I, but I did not do nearly as good. My main pick, Tony Finau, was the only one to make the cut. I think he finished like 72nd or 75th, something like that. I also picked Matt Fitzpatrick and Gary Woodland, who both missed the cut. So poor showing, but, well, you know, let's get him back here for the U.S. Open.
We got to figure out a way to tally this up at the end to see, you know, we're going to do this as well for the Open Championship, but to see cumulatively kind of who did better here. Let's jump into it. So we got the third major of the year at U.S. Open, L.A. Country Club. It's going to be a shot maker's course. Everybody is just beyond pumped to see this course on TV, myself included. I've been watching a lot of the preview videos. I just watched a couple of the fried egg videos that have been out for a week or so. Recommend anybody check those out. I'm going to cheat here a little bit. I'm going to use a name I've already used, and okay. He's a name that's, I think, on a lot of people's short lists to do well. We just talked about him. That's Victor Hovland. Victor Hovland's going to be my pick for the Betway Boost this week, and he's going to be my main pick. Do you know what the boost is going down to?
Yes, I do. His normal odds are at plus 1,600. He's going to be boosted to plus 1,900, so 19-1. It should be out on the sports book as you're hearing this.
Nice. So we can get Victor Hovland at 19-1. He's my pick. Justin Ray, I'm not going to say he was, I don't think he was the stat guy on Twitter that led me wrong on Sungjae Im. But if you don't follow Justin Ray Goff, do so on Twitter. The stats that he comes up with are completely insane. But he put out one either today or yesterday. Just and this is a pretty simple one, but last three majors, Victor Hovland is minus 27. And the second best golfer is Scottie Scheffler, 7 strokes behind at minus 20. And Hovland just won the Memorial, taking it from our boy Danny McCarthy just a few weeks ago. So, you know, seems like a good bet. We'll see. I may be jinxing him, taking him here, but
I really like him. I mean, I've been rooting for him for many years, and he hasn't gotten it done. I mean, you know, he probably should have won the PGA if not for that embedded ball like situation on, I think it was like 16th or 17th pole on Sunday. So awesome. I love him a lot. He seems to fit the course too. But with my first pick, and I have to make a disclaimer here, you know, I think top of the odds sheet right now is Scottie Scheffler and Brooks Koepka. I mean, those guys, like, if you're not betting them to top 10 in a U.S. Open, then, I mean, you just have to. Like, they're not my winner pick, but, those guys really show up in these majors.
We're trying to make it interesting by not taking, like, the very top guys, but that's probably where your smart money is.
Right. With that said, I think my winner pick's going to be Cam Smith. He hasn't, you know, he's been on live tour, so we haven't seen him much, but this golf course seems to fit his game. Although there's not a lot of data about this golf course, they're saying that it's going to, the guys with the best short game and putting stats should separate somewhat. So Cam Smith is one of those guys, and, you know, he sneaky had a fairly good finish at PGA. I think he was top 10 and did okay in the Masters. So, you know, see how it does, but Cam Smith, that's my winner pick.
All right. Do we have what are his odds at right now?
25-1. I think it's plus 2,500.
Yeah, good value bet. I'm gonna take. So we chatted before, and I'm gonna leave you one of my second bets because I think he's a good pick. I'm gonna leave him for you because I got two other guys I really like. The next one. I mean, this is another one. It might be too obvious. He's the local kid, and there's another stat I that went up during a college. Right after the renovation of LA Country Club, the North Course in 2013, there was a big college tournament out there, and the winner of that tournament is the hometown guy there, Max Homa, and right now he's at 28-1, 3-1 plus 300 just a top 10. I love that bet, so I'm gonna take Max Homa. He's the local kid. He's SoCal. And absolutely. I think there's good value there.
Yeah, what did he? I think it was the Pac-12 playoffs or championship. He shot 60 or 61 around there, which is pretty absurd. So, I mean, you got to root for Max, especially him winning the Wells Fargo here in DC area. Love to see him win a major. That'd be awesome. Let's see. So that was Max. You alluded to a pick that you'd leave for me. That pick is Tyrrell Hatton at 30-1 currently. He's just been playing really good this year. That's really all you can say. I think if you look at like the data, golf trending shots gained, he's like top 5 or 10 this season. Yesterday at the Canadian Open, I think he made a charge for the lead there on the back nine and ended up T4 or something like that. But he's just playing really solid. So Tyrrell Hatton, you'll be my mid-range pick this week.
Love that pick. He seems due to do some real damage in a major. Always kind of lingering around. Last one suffered a little heartbreak just yesterday in the RBC Canadian Open. Got into the playoff and got the dagger to the heart with a 72-foot eagle putt by Nick Taylor. Tommy Fleetwood, you know, he seems to disappear in majors quite a bit, but obviously playing well, and he's 40-1 to win. And again, I think I saw him at 9-1 top 5. I like that bet. Might put a couple bucks there, but Tommy Fleetwood, he's going to be my number 3.
They say it's a approach play flusher iron players golf course out there at LACC. Really fits that mold, and he's putting the lights out right now. So it's awesome.
My number 3, I went down way down the odds charts for this one. Okay. And you know, he's with the professional golf world kind of seemingly in flux right now. I thought, who else to take the center spotlight than good old Uncle Phil here at LACC? I mean, he came out of nowhere to finish second at Augusta this year. He has an incredible short game, which is necessary around this course. And as we all know, he needs the U.S. Open to complete the career Grand Slam. You know, I don't know if he'll win, but I could see him showing out for this tournament. I love him at a top 10 or top 20, but his winning odds are plus 15,000 right now. So if you care to sprinkle on that, there's a big bank on that.
I mean, people have been saying this ever since the live thing started, but like, you can't even imagine, you know, the uproar of Phil winning. But then, you know, after he came second in the Masters, why not? But for with everything going on with the tour and live and the Saudis, for him to complete the career Grand Slam this week would be,
could you imagine?
It would be pretty mind blowing. But
yeah,
I mean, I wouldn't put it past him. The last, you know, I'm going to throw in one extra one just because anyone that follows me on Instagram, I post a whole bunch of stuff. I think I put it on Twitter as well. Went out to the U.S. Open qualifier at Woodmont Country Club in Rockville last week and followed around for a little bit, including the playoff hole, the local kid, Michael Brennan, who's at Wake Forest. And I could be wrong here. He's an underclassman at Wake Forest. I think he's going to go into his junior year. Could be wrong on that. But Leesburg native. Playing as an amateur in the U.S. Open, qualified at Woodmont. He's 33-1 to finish in the top 20. I like that bet. I might throw a couple bucks at Michael Brennan. Not saying he's going to win. Not saying he's going to sniff the top 5 or top 10. But maybe, you know, who knows? Backdoor top 20? I like that bet. I think he's going to be a guy we're going to see on the tour here soon.
I get to. We got to root for the local guys. And as Sam Bennett showed us earlier this year at the Masters, these young guys, these amateurs coming up have, you know, it seems like they're making their way into these, you know, big tournaments and playing well much sooner than, you know, we used to see out of these young guys. So what a thrill that would be if he can make a run this week. Absolutely. U.S. Open. Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm pumped for the U.S. Open. I know everybody out there is. So I appreciate it, Ellis, and hope our picks fare a little better this week. We'll be watching.
Absolutely. Thanks, Alex. Appreciate it.
All right, let's get to episode 69, our conversation with Jack Bonifant. Enjoy.
All right, we are out here at Argyle Country Club with Jack Bonifant. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
Perfect. How are you?
Fantastic. I mean, it's like 78 degrees. It's 1 o'clock on a Wednesday. We're looking over the first tee box.
Beautiful.
That's all I want to do right now.
So we were just chatting about
how long you've been a member here. You're a lifer.
Yeah, I've never been on this planet without being a member of Argyle Country Club. And I don't plan on being on this planet without being a member of Argyle Country Club.
Yeah?
Oh, well, 100%.
You're part of the family here.
Yeah, it's... my wife is from New Jersey.
Okay.
And it's come up about, you know, where... You know, you start a life together. Where are you going to live?
Sure.
And I don't think I really know how to be Jack without Argyle. I think it's that important to me.
So... You obviously grew up around here then?
Yes.
How? Where did you grow up exactly?
6 minutes that way.
Okay. So this is still technically Silver Spring?
This is Silver Spring, but it's unofficially Layhill.
Okay.
Layhill doesn't have a post office, but if you're from around here, you know what Layhill is.
Yeah.
And my dad grew up right off of Bonneville Road.
Okay.
Which is a mile away.
That's just a coincidence with his name?
No.
Okay.
So, my grandfather had a farm and my great grandfather had a farm, same place. And when the telephone was invented, they had to take telephone lines through the farm.
Okay.
And so when they did that, they took a road through the farm.
And named it
Bonneville Road.
Wow.
And so my dad grew up on, the Bonifant Farm, and my mom grew up across the street in Stonegate neighborhood.
Okay.
So we have a graveyard as well.
And that's all still Montgomery County, right?
Yeah. It's like right over there.
Right up here.
And so when Argyle came here, which I don't know the exact year, my dad grew up out here.
Got it. So your family in Montgomery County well predates the country club.
Yes.
And so he was an original member?
So my grandfather, I believe, not technically, because it used to be down like Sligo Creek area.
Okay.
Is where it originated. It was a 9-hole golf course.
Oh, really?
And then moved out.
Was it literally at where Sligo Creek is?
I believe so, but I could be completely wrong, and we're recording, so I'll make sure we'll look that up. Check my sources.
I've never heard that, that makes sense.
So he grew up out here. My mom was across the street. So there's a farm where I spend Thanksgiving, like a mile from here.
Okay.
And it's the original house.
And it's still in the family?
Still in the family. My uncle Chris, who's a member here, probably already teed off, lives there with his wife, Aunt Sherry. And there are certain parts of the house that have been there since pre-1850. And we have a cemetery, because, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Samuel Bonachant, I believe, is the oldest person in the cemetery, and it's pre-Revolutionary War.
Wow.
Yeah,
you guys...
We have some roots.
You guys go back in MoCo.
And my dad is the chief administrative judge of Montgomery County.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know any of that. That's pretty wild.
Yeah, he sits up straight.
Really?
Bring up the judge.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So you're essentially born here at Argyle.
Yep.
Before we get into everything about you,
mm-hmm.
For folks that have never been out here, I've only been out here a few times. I can count it on one hand.
Sure.
What's Argyle Country Club all about?
The membership.
Yeah.
The culture of this place is extremely welcoming, laid back, and focused on golf. And then I believe really in the past 20 years, they focus on growing junior golf. I'm on the board here now. Ryan McCarthy is our current president. And before we really got involved, we came up with a junior membership for kids that are 18 and under. Right now we have 40 junior members.
Oh, wow.
And I believe we have a waiting list.
And so a lot of those junior members are junior golfers that whose family members aren't necessarily...
Correct. Okay. So they are their own member.
Oh, interesting.
And there's probably 15 of them here right now.
Oh, wow.
And they're probably on the front body green or at the range.
And is the idea of that program to really foster an environment for junior golfers that are trying to play at the next level?
I think it's turned into that. I think from a club standpoint, it's about investing in your future.
Got it.
And I think we know our culture here of focusing on golf and high level amateur golf.
Okay.
I don't know what it is about this place that produces really good players.
Yeah.
But we've had, you know, obviously Denny grew up here.
Yeah.
Denny McCarthy.
Ryan is his brother.
Ryan is his older brother. Yep. Ryan's played in two U.S. amateurs. Before Denny, Kyle Stahl made it onto what was the web.com tour, now the Korn Ferry. And Pat Morardi has conditional status on the Canadian tour. He grew up out here. And so in just over there, we have our hitting room where you can kind of just go warm up, or in the winter we have a sky track.
Okay.
We hang all of the pennants of kids that play in college.
Oh, man.
And I don't know the exact number recently, but I think since 2008 we've put 25 or 30 kids into Division I golf programs.
Cool. And that's got to be motivating for the kids that are coming up.
It creates a pretty competitive environment out here. I bet. And then they just live out here. Yeah. And that's what I did.
That's awesome. Very cool. So is the program for the junior golfers that's really designed, or is it designed to help them kind of get to that next level, or it's designed to attract young golfers that want to take this game pretty seriously?
I think it's a ladder. I think there's a cause and effect argument that can be made there, right?
Yeah.
You get enough young, I think it's all about who precedes it, right?
Yeah.
I think Denny's a huge driving force behind that. And I think Denny's tournament out here, the Denny McCarthy Invitational that we have every September, is a huge part of that, because I think they come out here, they knew Denny grew up here, and then I think their parents spend a weekend here and find out that their kid can become a member at a extremely reasonable price.
Yeah.
As I'm now 33, we have guys that play with us on the weekend that have joined who were junior members.
Yeah.
Matt Barnes, who won the Metropolitan Amateur
a
few years ago, was a junior member, played at Villanova, then Georgetown, on his comeback. And we have a designation between 21 and 25 that I think allows kids or young adults that are finding their way via their career, but have an affordable way to kind of stay here.
Yeah.
Luke Schapp is another person that played at UVA, grew up playing as a junior member here, and he's now a member here as well.
You just recently played in the U.S. Disabled Golf Association, their national tournament. You're getting ready to play in the U.S. Adaptive Open at Pinehurst. You played in that last year. We're gonna kind of get into all this, because I want to hear about everything. To kind of frame this conversation to start at the beginning, because you had an impressive junior golf career as well. But how you're playing in the U.S. Adaptive Open, I want to tell the listeners a little bit about your disability.
Sure.
And if you don't mind, can you tell that story of how you came to have a disability?
Yeah. So I was born May 2nd, 1990. About 6 weeks later, my dad was on a trip. I think he was going to a wedding in St. Louis. And my mom was at home with me, and she went to the grocery store and left me with the babysitter for the first time. And we had a dog, and my babysitter had me at the top of the steps, and the dog ran under her feet, and she fell with me in her arms about a flight of stairs. So she broke her leg.
The babysitter did.
She had skin grafts on because of the skin that fell off from the carpet. And what happened to me was I split my head open. I have about a 15-inch scar on the top of my head. So I split my head open, fractured my skull. And really what saved my life is, and it's only about 6 minutes from here, the park police had a helicopter station a quarter mile from my house.
Okay.
And so when 911 was called, they were able to medevac me, and the helicopter was like not even a quarter mile away. They came and went into my cul-de-sac.
So they were there really quick.
Very quickly. And was able to rush me to Children's Hospital. Wow. My mom was notified at the grocery store. And then she got home, and I always remember her talking about how they wouldn't let her drive. So she had to take a cab. They wouldn't let her drive. So she had to have someone drive her to Children's Hospital.
Because she was so emotional about it.
And my dad was in St. Louis. And I think we'll kind of get into this and why I am first playing in a disabled tournament at the age of 32 last year.
Yeah.
It's like the worst day of their life.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what it was like to get a call while you're at the grocery store, right? It's 1990, so we don't have cell phones.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Right?
So how did they get in touch?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then my dad was in halfway across the country.
Yeah.
And so I...
Do you have siblings?
Yeah. So I have two older siblings that had to stay at... I think they went over to our next door neighbors and then spent a couple days at my grandmother's house. I spent, I think, 4 days in the ICU at Children's Hospital. Was told that, that I had bleeding in the brain. My skull was obviously fractured and split open, and paralysis would ensue. And then I spent the whole summer I don't know how they did this, but my head was open because at 6 weeks, and this also very much saved me as well. You're at an infancy, you're so moldable that they needed to see if my skull would grow back together naturally, or would it start to grow out from, I guess, the swelling of the injury. And so I spent that whole summer with my head open, and I went through a number of different things, but ultimately my parents were told that anything with bilateral movement was probably going to be out of play.
I actually had to look this up. Bilateral movement, meaning the use of both sides of your body simultaneously, or just any kind of...
So like riding a bike.
Sure.
Takes both sides of your body,
right?
Like opening a door, you can do with one hand. If you have to do anything with two hands, like we just moved the table.
Right.
I can do that pretty easily, right?
Yeah. You said, 3 weeks, 6 weeks?
6 weeks.
6 weeks.
So
obviously you don't remember. Well, I'm curious, what are your, I mean, 10 years of rehab, are some of your earliest memories just that in rehab?
Yeah. I mean, I had OT, BT, any type of T you can think of, 2 to 3 days a week for the first 11 years of my life. I've mentioned a lot of things that I got really lucky with, right? So the helicopter was right there.
Yeah.
Me being 6 weeks old allowed my body to kind of bounce back because it was so moldable. But really what is the ultimate thing that gave me the opportunity to live an extremely normal life, I believe, is my mom. She was a speech pathologist from Montgomery County Public Schools for 35 years.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And she knew exactly what to do every day for the first 3 years, the next three, the next three, the next three, to get me, or just give me the best opportunity to figure out what I could and couldn't do. I remember, or I don't remember, but my mom has told me that there was a drug I was taking at 6 weeks, just after my accident, that I think the purpose of the drug was to kind of stop the swelling, stop the bleeding, to kind of take the pressure off of my skull with the brain swell. And I had seizures every day.
Oh my gosh.
And I think she, I don't know the exact number, but she watched me like a hawk one day, and I had 53 seizures like in one day.
Holy crap.
And she walked into the doctor's office and was like, we're taking him off of whatever you're giving him.
This is while you're still an infant or what?
Yeah, so this was probably 3 to 4 months after my accident.
Okay.
And it was the right call.
Yeah.
So it's a tough start.
Yeah.
Tough start.
That's an understatement. Oh my gosh. You know, one of the questions I'm going to get to, because the whole, the bilateral movement, mm-hmm. and your limitations,
yeah.
But how good of a golfer, sure. you have become and became. At what point, so you were in rehab basically till you were 10 years old. At what point did you pick up a golf club?
So, yeah, I mean, I was in rehab. I mean, I'm always
still
in rehab.
Okay.
I just do it on my own now.
I see.
At 11, I was told that there really wasn't much more
I see.
That we could do. Mm-hmm. But I far exceeded any expectation as well.
Yeah.
I was part of a documentary for a master's program about kids that are given a diagnosis, but at age 4, I was hitting physical and intellectual, I guess, benchmarks that my parents were told that I wouldn't be able to do, and I was featured in this documentary. I remember that being like videotaped and like people sitting around a room.
And it was about children exceeding
yeah.
expectations.
Yes. Just about like what the diagnosis might be X, but
yeah.
here's how they've gotten to Y and beyond. And I hope that certainly helped some doctors kind of wait and see.
How do you officially refer to your disability?
Right. So I'm a left hemiplegic. So left hemiplegia is a partial paralysis of one side of your body.
Got it.
And so in my accident, I had, so your right side of your brain controls your left side movement and left side controls right. And so if, you know, I'm wearing a hat today, but if you feel my head, it's like the Grand Canyon on the right side. I mean, there's knots and holes, but then you put it on your hand on the left side, and it's just like a regular head. So, like I said, I have a scar of when it was split open. Technically, I have cerebral palsy from the accident, but that's something people are typically born with.
Yeah,
but left hemiplegia is the official diagnosis.
Interesting. Wow. So, at what point did sports become a part of your life?
I think like always.
Okay.
My dad played golf at UVA.
Okay.
My brother grew up playing sports. He played select baseball. He played golf as well. He played golf in high school. My sister played softball in high school. It was just like part of life growing up.
Yeah.
And certainly being a part of Argyle was a huge part of that. And at 2, I wanted to play junior golfers just like my brother and sister did.
Yeah.
My mom always jokes that she took me out there when I was 2 and counted every single shot that I took on 10 and 11, because that's where 2-holers used to play, and I think I shot like at 56.
Mm-hmm.
I alluded to this earlier, but getting into it later on, why I didn't start playing in disabled golf tournaments until I was 33 is because my parents raised me not to
look at it that way.
Yeah, there's a lot more to Jack Bonifant than just something that happened to me. Ugh, the guy just referred to myself in the third person. But there's a lot more to anyone than any one specific thing.
Sure.
We all struggle with different things. We all struggle with height, weight, speed.
Sure.
Bonifants are slow. Like I wasn't going to play. I wasn't going to be a football player even if I didn't have my accident.
Yeah.
You know, I played baseball and golf the most growing up. Mm-hmm. And I think, so kind of talk about the origination of golf compared to baseball. My dad just took me out to the range when I was young, and he thought, given that you typically would want your stronger side being your lead, he wanted me to play left-handed.
Okay.
And he, like, handed me a left-handed club and, like, turned around or something and came back to me, and I was just, like, all discombobulated. So we got a right-handed glove, or a right-handed club, and it, there wasn't, like, is Jack going to be able to do this? It was always just assumed. Like, why shouldn't he
figure it out?
I remember I took off the training wheels of my bike at 3. I don't know why, but I just wasn't going to let, I don't know, there was other kids in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
I just wanted to ride my bike. And then when I started playing baseball, my dad handed me, I guess, a right-handed mitt, typically for someone who throws left-handed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just like, let's figure this out. And so I played baseball until I was like 13, like Jim Abbott, where I would catch and throw at the same hand. And usually an umpire would stop the game when I was pitching or playing first base and just ask my dad if we could get this kid the right mitt.
Yeah.
And then he would inevitably like talk to him for a few seconds.
So like in baseball, you're throwing with your right hand. Yeah. And then you're holding the glove with your left hand. And then as soon as you let the ball go, you're immediately putting the mitt back on your right hand, like Jim Abbott.
Yeah, just like Jim Abbott. There are a number of things that have led to the ultimate success of leading a normal life. Number one being my mom. Number two being a number of things that happened that day that were really lucky. Mm-hmm. Three is, I've never known anything different. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it's like to be able to just use your left hand to grab something.
Yeah.
So my mind, like I never had this change, right? So
I'm sure Jim Abbott feels the same way.
Right. So it's normal to me. People always ask, like, what does it feel like to hit a golf club?
Yeah.
Probably not that different.
Yeah.
But I think the best way I could compare it is, like, take a few fingers off. Or, you know, when, like, your arm falls asleep? Mm-hmm. But, like, right before it fully falls asleep, you get that, like,
tingling
sensation. Yeah.
Sure.
There's a lot of that, because if my brain is not connected to what I'm seeing and I'm doing, I won't feel it.
Yeah.
And it's a really hard thing to try to describe to people, but I look up to my parents so much because they just never let it get in the way of allowing me to find a way to be able to do it.
Right.
Right? And so I wasn't raised any different than my brother and sister. I still had expectations. I still had...
Were they athletes? Or are they athletes?
Yeah. My brother's close to a scratch handicap. He has 3 boys. And one of them plays select baseball, so he doesn't play golf much anymore. But
yeah,
he's a really good player.
When you started to play golf, because of your limitations, did it take you longer to catch up with your brother? Like, did it take you longer to get good, or were you figured out pretty quickly?
I think I figured it out pretty quickly. So there's a story that he has brought up a few times. The first time that I beat him, I think I was 12.
Okay.
So he's
how much
5
older?
And a half years older than I am.
Oh, wow.
So we were playing here at Argyle. And we both played terrible on the front. I think we shot like 43 on the front. And then I made 3 straight birdies, 12, 13, 14. And then his putter ended up really high in a tree. And we took like 40 minutes to get it down. And that was the day that I finally had beat my brother.
His putter just somehow ended up high.
Somehow.
Got it. Cause, well, because he started to see the writing on the wall that he was going to lose, that he was going to lose to his kid brother.
Yep.
Wow. So your junior golf career, one of the things is I was kind of doing some research on you, and I want to say earlier on here, because I first kind of learned of your story only recently, last year. I heard a great podcast you were on, a great interview called The Big Players Only, and you tell some great stories there. I think some more specific stories that we're here not going to talk about here today, because we're going to cover like a wider range of your life. And also, I encourage people to go listen to that one. Yeah, to hear. You tell a great story about you and your brother getting hole-in-ones at the Cradle and some more specifics in the U.S. Adaptive Open that we probably won't have time to get to, so I encourage everyone to check it out. But in listening to that podcast and doing some research on you, like, you had a heck of a junior career. I mean, I saw that you won the Bobby Bauer. How old were you when you won the Bobby Bauer tournament? I was
16.
And the Bobby Bowers is a highly regarded, it's here locally, but highly regarded.
Yes.
Junior tournament was it at Springfield then?
Yeah.
Always
at Springfield.
I think
it still is.
Yeah.
I won in 2006, and then I actually lost in the finals in 2007.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I made it all the way back.
That's still a big deal, though. Right?
Yeah, and it was actually pretty funny. The trophy that stays there is like this enormous thing.
Yeah.
And they accidentally put my name on twice for 2006 and 2007. Before the tournament even. I don't know why they did it. Okay. But like, it was so funny because Quinn Sullivan was the head pro when back in 2007. Like, he was really rooting for me to just win again so they wouldn't have to send it back.
Did they wait before they fixed it?
I think so. But that's funny. I didn't pull through.
That's funny. Yeah. So you played high school golf. I saw a good counsel then in Sherwood.
Yep.
But you were an all-met golfer. I mean, you were...
My senior year.
I mean, that's no small achievement.
Yeah.
How good of a high school golfer were you?
I was okay. I was good. I was good.
Yeah.
I was a little late.
Okay.
And I think we can kind of get into, first experience. I bloomed a little late, right? Okay. So I won the Bowers going into my junior year.
Okay.
And then senior year at Sherwood is when I made all met. So I won Montgomery County Player of the Year. And then I lost by three in the state championship. Alex Hoffman, I think he's over at Columbia now as the assistant pro, but a really good career.
Okay.
He won that year. But I was a little bit of a late bloomer. I had no offers. I wasn't recruited like by anybody. I had a few letters because my uncle was a head golf professional in Roanoke, and he knew a lot of college coaches, and I got a few letters. But I think a great way to describe my junior golf career is I hadn't won anything until the 06 Bowers.
Okay.
And AJGA was like gaining steam. Mm-hmm. It was important, but not like what it is now.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember, maybe that was a huge day.
Right.
I made a putt on the 18th to win. Kid who had committed to going to UNC Wilmington. And I walk off the green, and Quinn Sullivan is like, I want you to meet somebody. And I was like, great, cool. Like, I'm on cloud nine right now. Like, I'll talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And it was the head coach of VCU. And he had, like, his van there. Like, it was very obvious that the VCU head golf coach was there.
Okay.
And I was going into my junior year. I didn't think it was, like, too late to be recruited. And he was just, like, talking to me for a little bit. And he's like, you know, he played really well. Where are you thinking about playing? And I was like, I hadn't really thought about it, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't have any offers. But my brother just graduated from James Madison. My mom went to James Madison. It'd be pretty cool if I played golf at JMU. And I was like, but you're the head golf coach of VCU, correct? He was like, yeah, I think you'd be a really good player for JMU. So, like, I just, like, I, like, the high.
Do you think he said that because of the way you responded to his question, or?
No.
No.
Like, I ran, JMU and VCU are in the same conference.
Interesting.
So, like, I saw him. But, like, it was just good, but not. Yes, which is cool. It worked out.
Did you get to play against that coach a couple times?
Yeah.
He sounds like a bit of a dick.
A little bit. I think he's still the coach now.
Well, let's get to JMU. So you walk on at JMU.
Yeah, so I am the last walk on in the recent history of JMU golf.
Really?
Yeah.
Because they stopped accepting walk-ons, or just no one's been good enough to?
They stopped accepting them.
Interesting.
I mean, I get both sides of that argument.
Yeah.
Right? The best players are there. Yeah. Let them play. But there's also like a process.
Sure.
There's a system.
Yeah.
And having people just show up, and also about commitment. Like, people need to know what they're getting into, and it's a cool idea to be like, yeah, I'll go out to for the golf team. And
you go into the story, which is, you know, a 6-day slog of 6 rounds in a row to walk onto that team. You talk a lot about that on that Big Players Only podcast.
Yep.
Did they have any? Did the coach know you were coming, or did you just show up for?
I think I crashed his office. I went for like a summer visit with my mom. Okay. I think, and she was like, "Let's go see if he's there." And I remember talking to him for a little bit and just introducing myself. But there was some type of process where I knew a tryout was happening. It's not like I showed up to freshman orientation and I was like looking at the bulletin board and being like, oh, there's a JMU golf tryout. Like, I was very aware that it was a possibility.
Yeah.
But I remember quickly realizing that I could play. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like these guys were at some different level and,
right,
you know, that came out in the tryout.
So you made the team. How do you look back on your college golf career?
I was lousy.
Yeah.
I was terrible. And there's a lot that goes into that.
Sure.
You know, it's all in the JMU. So JMU reached out after the adaptive and had me on, which is really cool because JMU's kind of reached out a little bit more about just involving me, like, in the golf team and JMU sports.
Was your story, like, your backstory?
No.
Was that a known thing? Was it to your competitors? I imagine to your teammates, right?
After a while.
Okay.
Yes. But I think also, and I know as we kind of get into kind of what I do now,
yeah,
you don't really want to hear about how hard it is for someone as, like, he's clearly at your ability level. Or,
sure.
Or if I beat you.
Yeah.
Or you beat me, but, like,
I hear you.
Like,
yeah. Yeah. It's tricky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, as we were kind of building up to talking about the adaptive and the disabled golf, is like, I've always thought of myself as more of just a local amateur player.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly I had aspirations to play professionally when I was younger, but my scores weren't there and I wasn't going to waste my time trying to play professionally when everyone and their mother was trying to do it.
Yeah.
But I always knew I could play for my whole life. And that's what's really cool about golf.
You clearly had game. And I think I heard you mention that even today, do you still play to a +2 handicap?
Yes.
Which is insane. If you knew my handicap, you'd beat me by 100
strokes. I think I'm like a +1.9 if you're being...
Okay. Is there anything about your game with your disability? Like, is it... Like, do you have an unusual swing? Like, is it anything visual? I'm just curious. I mean, we all have unusual swings.
Yeah. So I think you would have to ask, like, people that have played with me enough, right? So, about a year ago, I started playing with a brace.
Okay.
And I was just like doing research if I was
a brace wear.
Yeah. So I wear a foot and ankle brace.
Okay.
I think it's called ankle and foot orthopedic. So I grew up, I was never without a brace for the first 11, 12 years of my life because of my, like, so my gait, I don't have the signals coming from my brain to, like, let muscles relax. So I'm constant, my left side is constantly tight.
Oh, okay.
So going, kind of connecting this to why I was a lousy player in college, on top of just, like, trying to manage school, having a good time, competing. I'm a lot better now at preparing my body to go play than I was at 20. And also in college golf, you play in horrible weather all the time, especially if you don't play in the South.
Right.
Like, you're playing in Harrisonburg in February, And then we would go to, I remember we played in junior year, I played at the Wilmington Landfalls, like 7,200 yards.
Okay.
It was like 40, blowing 25. And it was February. So like, I didn't play every day up here. It was probably really colder than you couldn't really. And so what I've learned is what my body needs to be able to compete a lot better. And there's a lot of preparation that I go through now. That has come with maturity and patience and learning what my body needs, but I'd much rather it be 95 than 35 because my muscles just can't relax like yours can and just operate, because if it's cold, then my muscles get even tighter and it takes even longer to warm up. But kind of talking about my golf swing, you'd have to ask the people that I play with if I look any different. It's a rarity that I get asked about it. Now that I wear the brace, I get asked more. When I was younger, I would not want the brace because I wouldn't want to be asked about it. But at 33, I don't really care anymore.
Yeah. What about just thinking of what people might be curious about? What about like stamina, literally walking 18?
Walking's fine.
Yeah.
I train a lot because I want to be able to compete, and it's harder for me to stay at a level of, I guess, physical fitness than an average person. So I have to work harder. And that's just.
But the fact that you're now in your 30s, you've got a full-time real job,
yes,
and you're still a plus 1.9. Are you as good? Are you about the same player that you were then, or worse, better?
I'm way better than I was in college. Yeah. Way better. Yeah. Probably the 40 pounds. Like I was. So to get back to your question,
40 pounds, which direction?
Heavier.
Then.
Than now. No, than I was. So in sophomore year, I weighed 157.
Okay.
I was 6 feet, 157. I couldn't hit it out of my shadow. Yeah. And so to your question about, is there anything like noticeably different?
Yeah.
If you played with me, you wouldn't realize how much shorter I hit it than the people that I'm competing with, but it's consistent. I struggle to generate swing speed like top-end amateurs.
Got it.
And that's why, like, is that why I haven't competed in a U.S. amateur? Or no, I think it's so hard. And, it's gotten a little uncomfortable, but I know it's a good... I want to share because if it helps someone with a kid that they're trying to get into sports, then that's kind of why I've now done my third podcast. But I also want to be respectful of the guys in the area that have excelled. Yeah. We have a ton of players in the area that have played in U.S. amateurs that I compete with that beat me constantly. But have I beaten them in A team out here? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if you ask me truthfully, do I think I'm a bit of a scrub? Like, yeah. Like, I'm a good local amateur, but I'm not really I haven't won in U.S. of Maryland.
But that's one of the things that's so great about golf, is everything's so relative.
So relative.
You think you're a scrub compared to the people that beat you all the time. Just why, like, I might be.
They don't beat me all the time.
Well, right, sure. But, like, you might be, somebody else might be a 15 handicap and they play with nothing but 25 handicaps and they think they're fantastic and they're good with that.
Yeah.
It's all very relative.
But why am I able to? I'm addicted to it.
Sure.
It's the man in the arena. There's nothing better.
Right.
And, I was just a regular guy playing Maryland. Golf tournaments, WMGA amateurs, Maryland amateurs. And, I kind of had to, set my career up, so I didn't really play as much. Mm-hmm. I played here a lot, but I didn't play in, tournaments a ton.
This is post-college.
Yeah, post-college, because I had to, kind of make sure I had a living.
Yeah.
But I was just a run. Like, I know all the guys that have won a ton of Maryland amateurs. I've competed against them a long time, but I was kind of just, a regular... above average amateur player until the adaptive showed up, and now I've gotten a little more attention, and I get that. But I also, to kind of go back to what you're talking about, JMU, did they know? I didn't want that to be the reason that I got recruited.
Right.
And I hope that you're getting this feeling from me. I can't be a poster boy for it either.
Right.
That's not, I think there are a lot more important things in life than the worst day in my parents' life.
Yeah.
And I can't live every day with that being the forefront. There isn't a minute that goes by that I don't have to think about it. Mm-hmm. With whatever I'm doing with my life. Typing.
Yeah.
Like there are jobs out there that I couldn't do. I've had awkward conversations with managers because I type with one hand. Mm-hmm. And they're like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. And I have to tell them, and it's like awkward. But I...
But your story is incredibly, it's incredibly inspiring. And I think, you know, obviously you don't want to be a poster boy, but no. But getting that story out there and being a part of it, I think does has the reverse effect of talking about it was the worst day of your parents' life to kind of honoring what they,
yes.
you know, were able and to yes. allow you and get you to achieve. I don't know if I phrased that right, but... So let's talk about more recently. So, yeah. you know, you're in your 20s, you know, you start a normal career, you get a day job, you're still playing a lot of golf, mm-hmm. and then the U.S. Adaptive Open pops up on your radar.
Yeah, so I still remember where I was sitting. I mean, I do this every summer, right? Look at how many days I can manage to be away from the office and what I want to play in. And I've always, you know, the mid-am is... obviously something that I've tried for a few times, the four ball. I've been a first alternate in that and U.S. amateur. And then I was just looking in on the USGA website, like U.S. Adaptive Open came up. And I remember just reading it and I didn't really tell anybody.
So you hadn't heard any like the press releases that it was coming or anything like that? Just
nothing.
Literally just came across it on the website.
I was just on my laptop.
Okay.
And I was like, I think I physically can qualify for this. I think this is...
Meaning I'm good enough or meaning I have the disability that would call...
Yeah, the physical limitation, I guess,
got it.
To qualify to play in that tournament. There were many people in my family that were like, you probably shouldn't play in that.
Because you're too able or
yes.
what?
Yes. And that kind of gets into, not to go on a tangent, but it
I imagine it's complicated.
Yeah, and I don't know how well I can explain this, but it's... I'm like caught in the middle, right? Growing up, I just played in regular tournaments, but I knew I was a little different than everybody. Mm-hmm. And if you played with me enough, you kind of learned about it. Mm-hmm. But on the other side, and this happened to me at the USDGA, I had someone in the last day of the tournament, like,
what's your deal?
What happened to you? Like, what?
Almost like questioning your qualifications.
Yeah, like, why are you here? Right. And that's why I can't. Like be the,
yeah.
I can't carry the flag because
you'd be explaining it every 2 seconds.
Yeah, or again, like I said earlier, there's a lot more to me also than something that happened to me 33 years ago.
Yeah,
and that's how my parents would say the same thing.
Yeah.
It's important. It's a connection that the three of us have.
Yeah.
That is has a profound impact on all three of our lives. But we don't talk about it every day. We don't.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think it's so complicated. But that you talking about it and you being a part of it brings so much awareness because neurological disabilities mm-hmm. are so often unseen or unable to be seen.
Right.
And so people assume that next person is just like them mm-hmm. when there's a lot going on that you can't necessarily see.
But I think you could say that for anybody.
Sure.
Everybody's life is complicated.
No doubt.
No one knows what goes on. You know, you stop.
Yes. Right?
You stop at a red light and stop next to someone that you're probably never going to see again in your life.
Yeah.
Imagine all the things that are going on in their life.
Absolutely.
And sure. It's mine a little bit more at the forefront. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I'm glad that we're sitting and videotaping this because if we were walking, like I don't know if I could watch it,
right?
Because I see everything.
Yeah, that's what makes I imagine these tournaments complicated. Like, correct me wrong, like the we mentioned the USDGA, which I did a podcast. They had their national championship at Laurel Hill last year. Forgetting which episode it was, but if it was last year, look it up. They have, and I'm, this is a question, not a statement, because I don't know. But correct me if I'm wrong, the USDGA, the way they do theirs and the US Adaptive Open, there's like different classifications for, you know, what type of disability you have. And so you're competing against different people. That's the USDGA, right?
So the Adaptive did that as well.
Oh, they did. Okay.
So you have like...
So you can win in different categories.
Yeah. So I think I won my category in the USDGA, but I just wasn't really interested in winning the category.
I gotcha.
So... not to
versus like an overall
kind of thing. I'm there to play in the whole thing.
I see.
And not to demean that, but like I went there with a goal.
I see.
There are different categories. So there's like leg impairments, there's intellectual impairments, there's seated players, there's and I know I brought this up on the big players pod. The seated players, I was the most impressed with them compared to other people that have disabilities and have qualifications of why they're there. But the patience it takes for a seated player to play 18 holes was the most impressive thing I've seen. I played, I've now played four rounds, two tournaments with a seated player. And you're just getting a glimpse into what their life is every day. Mm-hmm. So, just to give an example, seated player is 8 feet. They have to drive up parallel, make sure they're close enough. They can move the ball so that they can hit. Then they raise the seat so they can get into an athletic position the best that they can to then hit the shot. Well, 8-footer, they miss it, and they hit it 3 feet by. They cannot turn on the green because of the grass. So they have to go.
That's just policy.
Right.
Yeah.
Because they're in a golf cart. I mean, it's just like watching guys when
they're just told you can't do that because you're going
to
mess up the green.
Right? Right. So they have to drive all the way off the green, U-turn, and then come back. And that's just a small factor of what it takes for them to actually
incredible patience
play. And it's just the patience that it takes. Yeah. And that was the most impressive thing that I saw. In both my experiences, just the patience that it took.
Yeah.
So
the U.S. Last year was the first U.S. Adaptive Open at Pinehurst.
Yeah.
Second one is coming up in July.
Yep.
And you're in it again, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
So again, you go into lots of details about last year and that big players. But I encourage everybody to take a listen.
Yep.
But based on your takeaways from last year, you were in the final group, came up short.
Yep.
It was the first one, TV cameras.
It was awesome.
Give us a quick recap of last year and what are you taking from last year into this year?
So quick recap is there's like a professional tour in Europe that travels with the DP World Tour and hosts adaptive tournaments on Wednesdays and Thursdays before the DP World Tour plays.
Okay.
So there are, my competition is traveling the world and playing on this.
And so it's all adaptive golfers are playing on this.
Yes. And so I think there's like 12 to 15 of them. And I think there will all be.
It's almost like where we have pro-ams before our tournaments, they're doing this.
Yes. Okay. And I think there's like a small purse. I remember talking to like the president of it and like, I have a job. So like that wasn't an option.
Yeah.
But again,
are they paid?
Right. And then they have sponsors.
Not getting rich, but they're getting.
No, I don't think they're getting rich. But I mean, they can do it.
Right.
So they're making a living in some capacity. But just like anything else, it takes reps to prepare. And I'm going up against people that are putting in a lot more reps than I am.
Yeah.
Because of a lot of conditions, and that's fine. But from a preparation standpoint, for your listeners who have played in a USGA event, it's a circus. There's just a lot going on.
Yeah.
So just knowing that going in, I did a good job last year of finding, there was like a tennis court that I went to kind of off away from the clubhouse that I would stretch at and just kind of get away from the, how can I say this? People with like traveling groups. There was just a lot of people around all the players.
Okay.
And then there was me. And I was kind of by myself.
You didn't have an entourage?
Not an entourage that was watching me hit golf balls. I very much had an entourage that watched me play.
Yeah.
My parents were there.
Okay.
My now wife was there. Her parents came down. I had my an aunt that came, and my godson was able to come and watch. So, like, I had an entourage.
Okay.
But, like, they weren't handing me my 7-iron or videotaping me for Instagram.
I see.
Just preparing myself for that and knowing what I need to do to be ready to play.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long day. Mm-hmm. The round, if they set up the rounds similarly, like it's five and a half or 6 hours.
So it was more than one day though, right?
It was 3 days.
3 days, right.
So playing with a seeded player, I'm more prepared to do that now. Mm-hmm. I think Brooks talked about it at the Masters compared to the PGA Championship, about how much he slowed himself down,
right.
Walked slowly. Mm-hmm. It's just a very long day, but it's understandable. Like it just takes these people, takes the seated player a long time to play golf. Like it's just so hard for them.
Yeah.
But you just got to go do it.
Were you surprised by the quality of the competition, or how good some of these people?
I wasn't.
Yeah.
I think.
The winners were under par, right?
Yeah. So the winner was Simon Lee, who I believe has Asian Tour status. So it's an amateur and a professional tournament, okay. Which I don't think people know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So I think those who were in the top, I finished seventh. I think there was only one other amateur that beat me.
Okay.
The others were professional golfers.
Oh, wow.
So Simon Lee plays on the Asian Tour.
Yeah. I saw like Ken Green was in there.
Yeah, I played with him at the USDGA.
Is he a character? I've read a good portion of his book.
Yes.
And
an unbelievably sad story.
Yes.
Unbelievable. So
yeah,
encourage people to look into that. We probably can't dive into he had an RV accident, lost multiple people in his family.
Yes.
And very nice guy.
But he was on the tour for a long time.
He's won 9 times.
Played 9 times on tour. He was on a Ryder Cup, right?
I think he played multiple Ryder Cups. I could be wrong. He's won multiple times on the PGA Tour. And he had really critical things to say about the pace of play of the PGA Tour currently, which is really funny to hear.
You can tell by reading his book that he is a personality.
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah. I did a good job of balancing of like, I can't be a poster boy, not to diminish other people that have used it to bring attention to their foundation or something like that. My experience of being disabled and playing in these tournaments, but not really wanting to carry the flag to promote disabled golf everywhere. And he had a very similar, he just wanted to play soccer. And he just wanted to compete.
Yeah.
And what drove me to the adaptive and to kind of bring this a little bit more into the forefront than I do in my regular life is I want to be a Paralympian. That has been in the back of my mind since I was 18 years old when I played at JMU and then at just like any other washed up college golfer figuring out how you're going to find ways to compete after college with a job. Golf is not a Paralympic sport yet.
Mm-hmm. Is it on the table?
It's like coming up, 2028. The Paralympics are in LA, but golf wasn't a part of it. So 2032 would be Australia. And in a perfect world, there's politics in anything. And so a big driving force behind me playing in these adaptive golf tournaments is to keep my name in that
conversation.
In those circles
as
that becomes a reality. And I don't think there would be any better way than to, I think I'll have kids by 2032 being a Paralympian at 42, I think golf is unique that I would be able to do that.
Yeah. A lot there. Congratulations. So you mentioned that you're now married.
Yeah.
When we were coordinating this, you're going on, you just got married this year.
Yeah, in February.
Congrats. And you're going on a honeymoon in a couple weeks?
Yeah, so after the Maryland Amateur.
After the
Yeah, she's the best.
So you're competing in the Maryland Amateur?
Yeah, next Thursday.
Oh, nice.
At Chartwell.
There's a bunch of folks from Argyle, right?
There typically are.
Yeah. a recent winner, Jake Griffin, right?
He won it here last year.
It was here last year. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. He's been on my list of people to talk to.
He's probably outside.
Is he real? Yeah. I'll track him down. That's cool. Are you able to share what you're doing for your honeymoon?
We're on Savannah and Charleston.
Oh, nice.
We're going to play the ocean course.
I was going to say, there's some golf down there.
We're going to play Turtle Point. And actually, someone that I think would be really cool for you to talk to is a member here, grew up with me. His name is Justin Nogay. He used to be a former owner of
I know that name.
Peak Golf Fitness.
Okay.
And he started his own gym in Charleston.
Oh, really?
Very recently, and works with. So he was he's the Stone Ridge Girls High School coach still, and has started.
But lives in Charleston?
Yeah, so he commuted that this year. I don't know if he'll continue to do it, but he started like a girls' high school championship.
Oh, interesting.
Very recently, because, you know, when I was coming up, there weren't a ton of female high school players. But there was enough, and now there's like full teams, and so I think they're starting to like have their tournaments. And Justin's been a part of that.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
So we talked about this a little bit earlier on, but I was having some camera issues.
Yeah.
Let's bring it back. But it's clear you're passionate about this club. Your family goes back forever, but you're heavily involved with the club competitions.
Yes.
You guys have won a few championships.
Yes.
I understand you guys didn't have the result you wanted here recently.
2 years in a row.
2 years in a row.
So we've never won the spring, or maybe they did way back when, but I don't think so.
So I didn't grow up. I'm not a country club guy, so I don't know all the inner workings.
You got to throw that around. Country club guy.
No, but the only reason I do throw that around is I'm not super familiar with like the schedule of interclub competitions.
Oh yeah, it can get pretty intense.
Like how many are there?
So we play in two a year.
Okay.
Maryland State Golf Association puts on one in the spring, and then the Washington Metropolitan Golf Association puts on one in the summer.
Okay.
And you asked me earlier about like what's the culture of this place, and we kind of took a tour of the clubhouse, and our team championships are very much a part of like the artwork here.
Yeah.
It's something that. It's just part of like the fabric of this place. We really care about it. And I think when you put a focus in on golf at a country club, sometimes country clubs are more focused on like a family experience or socially, or tennis is more pronounced. This is a golf club.
Yeah.
And there's probably some members who are upset if I say that, but it is.
Yeah.
It's a golf club. And I mean, growing up, my dad played on the A team here, and I had two options on Saturdays. I could mow the grass early and come out with him and watch him play A team and then play and practice on my own, or I could stay at home and cut the grass later.
Yeah.
I usually cut the grass in the morning and then come out with him.
Does the result of you know, considering this, you know, this is a golf first club, or at least a lot of the golfers view it that way.
Yeah.
That these, and I've heard Argyle referred to as, you know, more of a working man's club. There's a few of those around.
100%.
So does that mean that these inner club competitions, when you're playing some of the clubs that wouldn't be referred to as your working man's club,
like those down county?
Sure, exactly.
Yeah, it's good with that.
Yeah, sure. The down county clubs. You guys want to win real bad. And these are taken really seriously. And when you do, there's a big celebration.
I think it's more of the local golf associations. I don't think every state has exactly what WMGA and MSGA have been able to do. Mm-hmm. And I think you have buy-in across the state and across the region, whether it's the DMV with WMGA or the state of Maryland. I know the clubs in Baltimore don't have something to play in the summer, and the clubs in Virginia don't have quite the same thing to play in the spring. So we're lucky enough that we get to play in both.
Yeah.
And it's just I think also the format has a lot to do. It's just so, it's so much fun.
Is pretty much every club a part of it? Like the WMGA, for instance.
Yes.
So like every.
So if you're 60 miles from the Washington Monument, and you have to have, I think, people that are paying to be a member in some type of capacity at your club. You can't just, you know, bring Northwest, which is a golf course very close to here, doesn't have a team because they don't really have like an official membership. I could be wrong, but. You have to keep your handicap somewhere so you don't just like recruit people to come over to your golf course.
Right.
And so it creates like roster building and stuff like that, right? So
there's no like e clubs, like, you know, like in Virginia, they have these.
Right.
There's none of that involved. Right. Interesting. What about the MSGA one? No. Same thing.
So, I mean, there are a lot of public golfers just that play in the MSGA.
Oh, there are. Okay.
Yeah. And so I think it's just a matter of. Like where you keep your handicap.
Yeah.
And they've done a lot better job of policing that recently, which is great. It just makes it fun.
While we're on Argyle, what about the course itself?
So I was thinking about this when we were talking about just the amount of good young players that have come through here and why that is. You know, Denny McCarthy is statistically the best putter on tour, I think, 3 years in a row.
Yeah.
And he grew up.
Easily make the argument he's the best putter on the planet.
Yeah. And he grew up here. Why is it that it creates really good players? The golf course is fun. It's not the best. It's not even like a top 15 course in the area. But there's a wholesome, classic feel of it. Mm-hmm. It's short. Ryan McCarthy and I have been very much trying to bring it to this century. For a while, it's got old push-up greens.
How so? Meaning lengthening it, or
So we've been able to lengthen a few areas. I know a lot of the committees and the board before I got involved have been looking at it for a long time, and I would much rather lengthen our already long holes to make that impact a lot harsher on the overall difficulty of the golf course than taking a 320-yard hole and making it 360.
Yeah.
That didn't really change how you play it that much. So I think we've been able to take some pretty high-impact areas and lengthen them. We have a par 4 of 491, and we have a par 4 that's 470.
Got it.
And that makes this 65-80 golf course play a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. I think it's also important for us country club guys, as you identified me earlier.
I just said I wasn't. I didn't.
I think it's really important if you're going to spend as much money as a member does, an initiation fee, it better be fun every day. Mm. And I think Argyle's best quality, aside from the greens are always really good and they are really fast. And Corey Wesselman is our director of greens and grounds.
Okay.
And he's outside of Kevin Taylor, who's our head golf professional. Mm. Those two are the best decisions that this place has made in 50 years. Those two have made this place known across the state. Our membership numbers are showing it. And the course condition on top of it being a fun everyday golf course. I think it's really hard to enjoy your club every day if you just get beaten up every time you play it.
Yeah.
I think about the members at like TPC Avenue.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be like, it's fun to play a really hard golf course. And I love playing difficult golf courses.
You play it every day, that can get rough.
Right. Not everyone is a scratch golfer.
Yeah. Right.
How are you building a golf course that 10 handicaps, 20 handicaps, beginners, mm-hmm. older, younger, women, men, whatever, can all enjoy it?
Yeah.
And I think that's what. That's the unique quality here, is that no matter what your level of play is, age, whatever, you have a really good time playing the golf course, and then you go in and the bar is pretty packed.
Yeah, that's a good thing. What else? So a couple things before we wrap up here. This is unprofessional of me because I didn't warn you this.
Okay.
But I think this is going to be published the Monday of the U.S. Open.
Cool.
Anybody you like?
Ooh.
So we're at LA Country Club this year.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I ask is for each of the majors, one of my sponsors is a sports book called Betway.
Okay.
And I've been doing my picks for each major with a listener of this podcast and a guy who's been helping me out. He's on the Betway team. And so far, both my picks for the first two majors have not made the cut.
Nice.
Rory McIlroy in the Masters.
It's a terrible
and,
pick. He has a mental block there.
Obviously. And now I'm forgetting his name. The young New York kid with the MLB patch. Why am I blanking on his name?
Yeah, Young.
Yes, thank you. Cameron Young. He didn't make the cut at PGA Championship.
My DraftKings lineup sucked.
So I don't know who I'm going to pick yet for the U.S. Open, but since I got you here, anybody that you like? Have you ever been out to L.A. Country Club?
No, but Ryan McCarthy, that's where one of his U.S. Amateur, he played in U.S. Amateur, one of his there, L.A. and Riviera. So...
Super excited to see it. I mean, everyone says just raves about
the course. I like the fact that they're going to a new place. I hate when it's at Pebble because they never move the AT&T. So you just go back to Pebble twice.
Right.
I hate that. I think the PGA Tour, every time U.S. Open is at Pebble, the AT&T should not include Pebble.
I agree. I don't know why they take majors. I'm the same way. I mean, to a lesser extent, Quail Hollow. I mean, they got a tour stop there. Why does the PGA Championship keep going back there?
Right. I think it's hard to pick against Brooks or Scotty and a major, right? I think those are two who will be in the top five.
Yeah.
I think Brooks, once he gets momentum, is really hard to beat.
What's your, I did take a peek at your Twitter profile this morning, and the one thing I took away from that is you're ready for a new football team name. What's your new team name?
Well, I think it has to be Red Hogs, Hogs, or Red Hogs. That's a whole other podcast.
The Hogs I've never really heard a lot of, but I like that. Washington
Hogs. It just makes so much sense.
Yeah.
It's too easy. The answer was right in front of them, and like they did for really my entire life post-1992 when they won the Super Bowl, it's not that they make a bad decision, but they make the worst possible decision and then go with that. Yeah. And then try to sell it to us that they are, you know, trying to do right by the organization.
Yeah.
One of my favorite expressions is don't pee on my leg and tell me that it's raining.
Right.
And Daniel Snyder has been peeing on the DMV in the Beltway area.
Yeah.
So as we probably wrap up, Beltway golfer, like where did that come about? You're from the area, would be my guess.
Yeah, I grew up right down the street as well. I grew up in Montgomery County.
Okay.
Was never a great, I played some high school golf, public golf.
Okay.
Walter Johnson.
Oh,
but I was not. I was a hack. Still am.
Yeah.
No, I've always loved.
Yeah. What do you love about it?
What I love about golf.
Yeah.
Or love about belt with the golf in this area. I mean,
just golf.
Just let's golf. There. You know, I was never a great athlete. I played a lot of sports. I was obsessed with sports. Basketball. Okay. Basketball was my main sport.
Makes sense.
But once you hit a certain age,
yeah, you top out.
You know, and I topped out early, but. Golf is something that it's unbelievably competitive. It's unbelievably challenging to get good. You can play it forever. You're outdoors.
Yes.
You're with your buddies. I love going out as a single and meeting new people. I mean, it's a great way to meet people. It's great. It's like there's a million awesome things about golf. And at some point, I actually had a conversation, or not conversation, but I thought to myself when I was getting this thing going. I didn't play a lot of golf in my 20s. I played a lot as a teenager, kind of moved away from it in my 20s for, you know, different things and got back to it in my late 20s. But I would play pickup basketball was my main thing. Mm-hmm. And you can't play pickup. Like, my body was breaking down on me. And I was like, you can play golf. You can play golf for the next, like, 60 years. Like, why don't I commit more of my bandwidth to golf? And it's going to pay off. And for me, it has.
So the podcast, where did that originate? Beltway.
I was in software sales, like I think you are now.
I am.
And back when I started Beltway Golfer, I was doing, like, I had a region. This was before you could do Zoom presentations for everything. Where I had to drive out and with my laptop and do presentations. And kind of the Mid-Atlantic was my region. And so I'd be driving around, sneaking in 9 holes, sneaking in 18 holes, and it's the old...
I've never been known to do that.
Right. So it's the old, you know, write or talk about what you know.
Yep.
And I originally, the Beltway Golfer started, I was writing reviews of golf courses. And
oh, then really?
When social media came up, I started taking pictures of golf courses, got a little bit of a following, and didn't start the podcast really until the pandemic hit.
Interesting.
So I started this podcast in June of 2020.
I think it's a cool area because, so as I'm on the board here, and so you kind of look under the hood a lot, just what goes into running a place,
yeah,
like a country club or a golf course, really. The Mid-Atlantic is the hardest place in the world to grow grass.
Right.
The climate is not helpful.
Yeah.
And it's just very interesting because I think there are, you wouldn't think this area would be such a golf heavy region.
Yeah,
it is.
What's interesting, when I tell people, golfers or otherwise, when they learn about mm-hmm. what I'm doing, one of the first things they'll say is, you know, there can't be that many people to talk to. So that's interesting. And it couldn't be further from the truth.
Right.
The more you get, the more you dive into it, the list of people that I'd be, you know, I think would be good for a podcast that are just in the golf world in the Mid-Atlantic gets bigger and bigger. It's not smaller and smaller. I'm not even close to running out of people.
Right. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, all right, Jack, we'll wrap it up here. I know I'm sure you got work things to do in your real life, but I wish you the best of luck in your second swipe at the U.S. Adaptive Open in July. And I know they show a lot of it on the Golf Channel.
So they showed like highlights last year, which was...
None of it was live?
No, none of it was live. I remember seeing them like record me,
yeah,
and then they showed it like later that night, which is very,
yeah,
like it doesn't get past me that my name's been on a leaderboard on the Golf Channel, and not a lot of people can say that.
And it's awesome.
Very cool.
Yeah,
it's just a really cool experience that I know that I'm going to get the opportunity to continue to have. But the Adaptive was the, I want to say, 18th to 20th last year. They moved it a week earlier this year. Because the Open Championship, I'm such an American. The Open Championship is that same week.
Yeah.
So I believe that they moved it a week earlier,
yeah,
so they could show more of it.
Yeah.
Which, it's just like, it's so cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's very cool. Well, I'm glad you're in it again. And best of luck with all your endeavors. And
you.
We will stay tuned and be cheering alongside you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Jack.
A good golf game, but I don't really care. I'm a regular dude living in D.C., and I want to know about D.C.-centric golf stuff. If you can tell me something that I don't already know, then that is great for me. I don't want the regular stuff. I want exciting stuff. I want different stuff. I want stuff I can't hear elsewhere, but I want it to be about D.C. golf.